This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
To Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, we just finished Memorial Day, and I want to play a very special song, and then I'm going to introduce my guests. Okay, well, Memorial Day is always very important to me because my father was in the Army. He was in D-Day, and he won a Silver Star. So I have always been very interested in the military and in promoting the military. So I am so happy today to have two guests in the studio. One is an American hero. He has a Silver Star himself and three Purple Hearts. Johnny M. Clark is just a fantastic author, and I'm so happy to welcome you to the studio today, Johnny.
Oh, thank you, Patsy.
Okay, well, we're going to be talking about all of your books. Particularly, we'll talk about the one where this bagpipe music is very relevant, right?
Okay.
Okay. And then my other guest has written a book about that is a story about someone who goes back to Normandy because he was in D-Day. And so I want to talk about this book because D-Day is coming up, and I think it's a very important book. And for anyone who has any relatives who was involved in World War II, they will really enjoy this book. And I'm so happy to welcome Tim McGee to the program. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, you know, we'll start with Johnny, but Tim, you can jump in here anytime because I want to talk in general. You know, it is quite unbelievable to me. At one point when I was young, after we finished Vietnam, and I was thinking, you know, those days, many of us young people at the time thought, well, wars are over. There aren't going to be any more wars, and we're not going to have to ever fight again, and it's going to be really, really great. And I even, you know, you hear about the deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan, but until you really think about the numbers. 4,486 U.S. soldiers have lost their lives, and 2,000 in Iraq, and 2,345 in Afghanistan. And of those, 168 have been women. So, you know, it really boggles the mind to think that we have had such enormous losses, over a million wounded, and in some very seriously, of course, one of the things, Johnny, you know from your days in Vietnam that a lot of people didn't survive. So a lot today, many of our soldiers who are very seriously injured would not have survived back in Vietnam, right?
Oh, no, absolutely. But even in Vietnam, our casualties, we actually had more Marines casualties in Vietnam than in World War II. And a lot of people don't know that, but we actually had more wounded and killed in Nam than we did in World War II. But fewer died because we had the helicopter. We could get them, you know, out of the battlefield a little quicker, usually, hopefully, sometimes not. But so even Vietnam was so much better for getting our wounded to a hospital than World War II was. That even though we had more Marines wounded in Vietnam, less died. And I know compared to what's going on now in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, those guys, they're getting them to a hospital bed pretty quick.
Now, of course, it one of the things, you know, we have now in the news, we're hearing all about Korea. And so many people don't understand quite where that fits in and why. Why are we now talking about a peace treaty with Korea after all of these years? And I was when I was thinking about the past few weeks when Korea has been big in the news, I've been thinking about your books. And one of them, particularly the No Better Way to Die, actually the front, right in the front of the book, you have a map of Korea in 1950. Tell us, let's talk about that and why, what's the relevance of the bagpipe music?
Well, that book, of course, they're not my stories. I interviewed a lot of old salts, and I interviewed a lot of the guys that were called the Chosen Few, because they made it through the Frozen Chosen in the Chosin Reservoir. And one of them was this man named Francis Hugh Killeen, who was an Irish gunnery sergeant, and he was as Irish as you could possibly be. Even when he wrote me letters, he wrote them like an Irishman would talk. He would write sentences like, and so Johnny, it may have occurred to you, how would a man defecate when it's 70 below zero? Well, let me tell you. And he would write like that. And so he would, that story about the bagpipes player, that's based on Francis Hugh Killeen. He was the regimental bagpipes player for the 7th Marine Regiment. And at one point, his lieutenant, who got the Medal of Honor, ordered that damn clarinet player, that's what he would call him, get that damn clarinet player up here, because the Chinese had just entered the war at Sudongni. And so when they came over the mountains, all the Marines thought that it was that the mountains were moving. You know, they were shooting up flares, and everybody said, geez, it looks like the mountains are moving. These flares are weird. Well, the mountains weren't moving. There were that many Chinese coming over the hills. And so they started blowing bugles, because that's how the Chinese military, that's how a platoon would tell another platoon, you know. They gave their orders through bugle calls out on in the combat field. And so this lieutenant got so ticked off about it, he said, get that clarinet player up here. And so Killeen had to go to the front and start playing the bagpipes. And he promptly got shot through the throat. It blew the bagpipes right through his throat. And he developed cancer in his throat years later, after Korea. And so he'd have to write his story to me, because he couldn't talk very well. But it just an amazing guy. He served with 3 Medal of Honor winners in Korea. And, I mean, he's a legend. He's the stuff that movies should be made of.
Well, it is just one of your wonderful books of military stories. Now, one of your books, Guns Up, is a bestseller. And, you know, it's so important, I think, for this generation to read stories about the wars. And which book do you want to tell us something about?
Well, I guess...
Or what's the newest book, as a matter of fact? Yeah,
I've got a new book right now with the Christian imprint at Random House. It's called A Waterbrook, and we'll see. I think it's got a chance. You know, it's we'll see. I haven't ever written a book that was just straight Christian market. All my books made the Christian market, but they made the world market too. You know, and they're all about, most of them are about war and about the Marine Corps. This one is it is about war, but it's about a miracle that happened to me, and a miracle that happened to Sergeant Mitchell Page. He got the Medal of Honor on Guadalcanal. He's the guy that Hasbro Toys made the G.I. Joe doll in honor of. It was Sergeant Mitchell Page. And he told me a story on his deathbed that it blew me away, and it would blow anybody away who hears this incredible story. At a turning point in the Battle of Guadalcanal, where it was literally a race between him and a Japanese soldier to get to what they were called Mahoney guns. It was a 30 caliber machine guns that the Marines had rigged up to fire 1,200 rounds a minute, which my M60 only fired 600. So they rigged these guns up. They fired so fast that you could just hear them, and you knew it was a Mahoney gun because no other gun sounded like that. Well, if the Japanese, all the machine gunners had been killed or wounded on Bloody Ridge on Guadalcanal, and the battle was literally about to go one way or the other, and it was a matter of whoever could get to this one machine gun position because the gunners were all killed there, and Mitchell Page was racing to it. He got there first, but the Japanese soldier dropped down at point-blank range with a Nambu 30-round clip, open fire on him, but Mitch had to lean forward to put his weight into this 30 cal to chamber around to kill this Japanese soldier. He went to lean forward to chamber around, and he said, "I was frozen," and he said, "I couldn't move one way or the other. I knew I was perfectly aware of everything that was going on. I knew this Japanese soldier was at point blank range and was about to kill me, but," he says, "I was at total peace, and I could do nothing. I was just frozen in place." The Japanese soldier opened fire, and 30 rounds burned his chin down to the lower part of his neck. All 30 rounds went right under his chin, burning his skin. As soon as the Japanese soldier fired the last round, Mitchell said, "I was released. I fell forward, chambered around, killed the Japanese soldier. We held that position. We held Bloody Ridge." Right after that, he led a bayonet charge to push the rest of the Japanese off the ridge. He had been bayoneted in the hand in that, so he was trying to get to his pack to get his first aid kit out, and he said his Bible fell open. Now, it was still dark, and he said it lit up like it was in gold, like it was golden light, and he told me, and this is on his deathbed now, he's telling me this. This guy wasn't a BS artist, and he was telling me the straight scoop. He said, "Johnny, it lit up so bright that I was afraid the light was gonna get me killed because there was still Japanese all over the place." And a verse glowed out of this glowing. He had a Gideon Bible in his pack, and it was glowing. This verse that meant a lot to him. It was his mother's favorite verse. And it's based on Psalm 121. "I lift my eyes to the mountains. From whence cometh my help? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth." Well, a couple of years went by. I mean, that story blew me away. Mitchell died soon after that, and I never forgot the story. But it wasn't something I went around thinking about all the time. And a couple of years later, I was dealing with my own war memories, and I was diagnosed with severe combat fatigue when I came back from Nam, and they like to call it PTSD. I hate that term, but I at one point, my pastor said, "Johnny, you need to go and be alone with the Lord," and I said, "You know, I'm going to do that." I'd never done it in my life. Buddy got me a cabin up in the mountains in North Carolina. Never been there. Black Mountain, North Carolina. Never been there in my life. Long story short is I ended up going for a frustrating walk because I'd been there 3 days and was frustrated to death in this cabin. Bears on the porch at night, and I'm setting up booby traps around this thing. I had my own little trip wires. You know, I'm back in Nam, so this was doing me no good. And I told my wife, and she said, "Take a walk. You got to take a walk. You sound awful." And I did, and I started walking until I reached this mountain called Graybeard Mountain. It was 5,000 feet. I was going to go 5,000 feet. I was just going to keep walking until I felt better. And I reached a point in a mountain stream, and I prayed, and I said, "God, what in the world am I doing in the mountains, away from my family and my business? You know, what's the point?" And I prayed, "Yeah, his favorite trait is humility." And I said, "Here I am climbing 5,000-foot mountain. I just had knee surgery a month ago. This is not humble." So I said, "I'm gonna go back down. I'm here to learn humility." And on the way back down that mountain, I was frozen as I stepped off. I stepped off a ledge, and I was frozen in place. And I know it sounds insane. They may put me away when this book gets published, but I was frozen in place. felt totally at peace, didn't know what to do. I mean, I was just there hanging in midair with one foot back on this ledge and one foot in midair going down a hill at about a 45-degree angle. When I was finally released, I turned around and an audible voice, I fell to my knees, and an audible voice said, "Johnny, get up. Johnny, I want you to walk a little further with me." I would have walked to California. I got up. I couldn't speak. I just walked up that mountain, and I kept walking until I went past that stream with that boulder where I had stopped, and I kept on going. And I came upon a great big boulder on the side of this trail, and on the boulder was Psalm 121, the same verse that was Mitchell Page's verse.
Wow. These things, it is. Sometimes these miracles happen. And it's funny what you say about combat fatigue and PTSD. I know my father also would not like PTSD. Combat fatigue, I don't know why they don't want to use that term, but that's actually what it is. You are sick and tired of fighting. Just sick and tired of it. Just can't take it anymore. And you don't want to remember it, and you don't want to anybody to ever have to go through it. It's just unbelievable. As I said, when I looked at the numbers, I'm constantly reading, and I'm always, up to date in the news. Until Memorial Day, I really had not looked at the numbers to realize how many people have died just since 9/11. And it's just frightening. And I hope so much that, you know, we can end all these wars, and it would be nice if we could end the Korean War peacefully, right?
Indeed.
Now, Tim, how did you get the idea for the book about Worthy McGuire? One, I love the name. He is a character. When the book is set in today, it's a modern story, and Worthy McGuire is a fascinating. You have really developed a character who, once somebody reads about Worthy, you never forget him. I found myself so taken with him. At first, I was like confused. Do I like this guy? And then I realized, this is somebody really worthy of knowing. So tell us about Worthy.
Well, Worthy McGuire was my attempt to pay honor to my father, who was also a World War II veteran. And when I grew up, when I graduated high school, this was the one kind of defining moment for me was, in talking to my dad, being a World War II veteran, he never really talked much about the war. He graduated high school in 1944 and joined up immediately. And so I thought about my graduation from high school, and I had been accepted to college and was thinking about where the next graduation party was. And my dad, on the other hand, had joined the Army and was at boot camp down in Texas. And he was, like I said, he never talked about it. None of his generation spoke about the war. And it was when Tom Brokaw wrote that book about the Greatest Generation, it kind of sparked an interest in me in terms of, that is right. I said, these really are kind of the Greatest Generation. And so I decided I'd like to write a book that honors that generation. And it was, in a sense, trying to explain and describe how that generation differed from mine and from my older brothers and the sacrifices that they made kind of just silently. And so that was the germination of it. The main character, Worthy McGuire, was actually based on a dear friend of mine who was actually a friend of my father's first, and he's Canadian of all things, but he was just this kind of a curmudgeon. He didn't have that filter in his brain that says, no, you shouldn't say that. he came out and said stuff. So his family, he passed away a few years ago, and I went up for his funeral and I was talking to his family. I was very close with his wife, and his kids said, my dad would say stuff and we would kind of cringe. But then on other times he would say, things and show his love for his family. And so I was trying to base a character off of this guy that says he's human. He's got a lot of good qualities, and one of his best qualities was trying to keep this promise that he made so many years ago. And, the book starts with him being in his late 80s, in deciding he wants to try and fulfill this promise he made during D-Day and realizing that this is the only chance he has to do it. And so also realizes that he's an older man and can't travel alone. He's in Michigan and he wants to go back to France. So he has to kind of seek the help of his family. And that's not an easy thing because it's a pretty dysfunctional family and he has become estranged with his son and his grandkids. So he reaches out kind of reluctantly to his grandkids to say, will you help me on this? And the only reason they help him is they don't get along with their dad at all. He's pretty oppressive, and they say, yeah, I'll go because it'll get me away from my dad and his new trophy wife and get out of here.
Well, one of the reasons I love this book is because you have developed a character, Worthy McGuire, as you say, a curmudgeon, but there is so much depth to him. And it is, when I come across a character like Worthy that really sticks in my mind and I can't get him out of my mind, when I, just little things will bring him back to my mind. And what I love is that this is not a sentimental book. I get a lot of World War II books where they're very sentimental and they're nice books, but I think sometimes readers won't relate as much to them. In this book, I think all readers will relate to the sort of dysfunctional family and then to the idea of somebody who wants to keep a promise, and that the nature of that, when it is so important to keep a promise that you make and then to work towards it. And so we're going to talk more about that too, because as you mentioned, the World War II guys, and like my father, didn't talk about it. Rarely you'd have to. It was only exactly late in his life that I could get my father to talk about things, because they just came back and they did their lives. They took. They just came back so it's really, I think, a very touching book. Also, because there are so many plot twists in your book, so many. It's just absolutely delightful. Now, I have to take a commercial break. We can have a commercial break, and then we're going to come back and we can talk to both of you about more things military and about how you did your research, too.
Okay.
Okay, we'll be right back.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660, or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow, and like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I would flip-flop all night long, I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you could move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
MyPillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I, or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543. From the author of gut-wrenching novels Guns Up and Gunner's Glory, now a gut-wrenching comedy, Section 8. One fan writes, Section 8 is inspired insanity. Johnny Clark should receive the Pulitzer Prize and his commitment papers in the same ceremony. You will laugh till it hurts. Section 8, it's 1946, and President Harry Truman has two goals in life: dump the U.S. Marine Corps and get reelected. Can he convince Congress that the Marine Corps is obsolete? He'll try, but first he wants to use them one last time. There's something he needs them to do, a little mission to China to steal something that one of his contributors need. It's dangerous, but who cares? Marines are expendable, or so he thinks. What could possibly go wrong? A lawsuit by the Vatican? An attempted assassination by a dead assassin? Flamethrower sermons? If that's not enough, there's a missing A-bomb. This book has it all. Even a love story. Remember, Section 8 is only a temporary state. You hope. Written by a true American hero. You'll love this book. Now available on Amazon. So get it today. Section 8 by Johnny Clark. Semper Fi.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back with my guests in the studio, Johnny M. Clark and Tim McGee. They have both written books that are just very timely. Tim's book is about D-Day, and we were just mentioning that. And then Johnny, well, he's written nine books. And of course, that we just played a promo for one of his books, which is a comedy called Section 8. And we were so happy to do that promo for you because the promo itself is funny.
It is. I like hearing it myself.
Don't you love hearing it? I love it. And that's Big Ed in the control room did that for you.
I know. I thanked him before. Thanks, Ed.
He did such a great job with that. And it puts a smile on my face every time I hear it, because I was mentioning to Tim that I was listening again to the Audible version of Section 8.
Oh, and good.
Yeah, I got it right here, so I've been listening again.
Didn't that guy do a great job on it?
He did a great job, a wonderful job.
I just laughed. You know when you're laughing at your own stuff.
Yeah, it's so funny. Now this is unlike Johnny's other books, which have a lot of serious combat in it. Section 8 is a comedy, and it's funny. And you know, when you first told me, when the first time you came in here and you said that Harry Truman actually wanted to get rid of the Marines, I didn't believe you. I mean, I thought, nobody could. He needs a Section 8.
He hated the Marine Corps. He tried to get rid of the Marine Corps, and he almost did it. You know, that's when we were talking about Korea earlier. Harry Truman had he was dismantling the Corps, and they were down to one regiment, which ended up being like a brigade. That's all that was left of the United States Marine Corps. He was discharging guys all at every Marine base in the country, and so the only Marines that were left with this one brigade. And when the Korean War started, the U.S. Army was an army in relaxation in Japan. They were having a great time in Japan. The war was over, and they were a peacetime army, and a private could live like a king at the end of the war in Japan. So they were falsifying their combat readiness reports, and I mean, it just, our army had collapsed, basically, because they thought the wars are over. And we have the atomic bomb now. You know, who needs an army, I guess. When the Korean War started, we sent these battalions of Army kids into combat who didn't even know how to use their 2.5 rocket launchers against the Russian tanks. And we had entire battalions just totally wiped out of young soldiers who didn't even know how to properly use their weapons. And the North Koreans drove all the way to Busan, and that's like taking over the state of Florida and driving all the way to Miami or Key West, and that's all that's hanging on. And at that point, MacArthur asked for the Marines. And the Marines came in, stopped the North Koreans, gave them their first bloody nose at Busan. Then MacArthur took the Marines around for the Incheon landing, and the rest is history. But if it hadn't, they were the only combat-ready troops we had left in America, because Marines don't do anything but train for combat.
Marines don't just sit around drinking pina coladas sunbathing.
No, it doesn't happen.
It's an ongoing tradition in the Marines that you train.
That's all. You have nothing else. I mean, you don't join the Marine Corps to get an education or the GI Bill You join the Marine Corps to kill people. That's your job.
And it's so good that they were ready. And I just still, I really, Truman should have been the one who was put in a straitjacket. Now, you know, I wanted to talk to Tim because, of course, now, Johnny, for your Vietnam books, you lived it, and so you knew a lot. Of course, you had to do research on the Korean War because that was before your time. But Tim, you had not been in the military, so for you, writing about World War II was quite a big task.
It was, and doing the research for Worthy McGuire was a kind of a consuming project, but. What I wanted to do, even though it's a fiction story, I wanted to make sure that I was staying as true as I could during the combat scene of the D-Day invasion to the history, as true as I could to that true history. So I did a lot of reading. Stephen Ambrose wrote a great book about D-Day invasion, and where he was down to, you know, combat units and squads in terms of where they landed and kind of what kind of resistance they felt, and also things like what the terrain was like in Normandy. So I tried to use that a lot in terms of when I was developing the story. And there was it's war. It's a terrible thing that's going on, but there was some fascinating stories that occurred that Ambrose wrote about and other historians wrote about that happened to the soldiers about, some of the paratroopers that landed miles and miles away from where they should have been in terms of the night before the invasion. So I kind of took all that in and thought, how can I weave a story that is going to stay true to the history yet be interesting to the reader and kind of get me from point A to point B? And one of the things I found very helpful and kind of amazing in a sense was one of the infantry divisions that was part of the invasion at Omaha Beach was the Fighting 29th, and they have a website. So I had Googled it, went to their website, and was able to actually work my way through that website to read the action reports that the officers had written after. And so again, I was trying to read that and absorb that and take that into account to say, how can I use this and make sure that I'm staying true to the history?
Well, I think you did a great job. As I said, one of the things for people who have not been involved in the military and who don't know too much about, you know, battles and aren't sure if they want to know, Worthy McGuire is such a good book for them to start with because you read about it and you have managed to capture by reading these action reports. And that's one of the great things about the internet is that you can get into so many documents that you would have almost been impossible before, but you can go back and you can see these action reports. And they do tell a story. And so that's what I thought was so brilliant about your book, that you took just enough to really make us feel and understand where Worthy was coming from. Mm-hmm. And I think that the sections that you wrote about the battle are so beautifully done. I was really impressed with it.
Thank you. Yeah, it was. I mean, it's funny. I think about I literally was in the weeds when I would start reading these reports and realize it was like 4 hours later, and I was like, okay, I got to move on. Yeah. But it was fascinating stuff.
It is, and it's really, when you think about what they went through.
Yeah, I always think about this, especially with Memorial Day. When I went to Normandy prior to writing Worthy, and that's kind of where I got the idea about the story. And one of the things that we did is my wife and two other family members and I went to the American Cemetery. And I don't have a military history. My father was in the Army, but that was kind of it. And yet, when we walked into that cemetery and walked into the middle of where all of those marble tombs were. And, you know, there was the cross and the Jewish star and the others that were unidentified in terms of their faith and their religion. I stood there and looked, and it seemed to go on forever.
It does.
In every direction. Oh, and it almost brought me to tears just to think about, A, the sacrifice that these young men made, and they were 18, 19, 20 years old. And B, this was one cemetery.
Yeah. I know.
There was probably hundreds of others all over Europe and in the Pacific. And you talk about the sacrifice, and you talk about kind of what Memorial Day means. And since that trip, it's never been the same for me to think about what that day means.
Exactly. You know, for me, it's always been an important day because since my father passed, I always think about him on this day. And, you know, I want people to understand what our young people are going through today, the ones who are facing combat, who are going out there, and it's just so tragic that we're losing so many people. And what can we say? We just hope that somebody somewhere along the line will get some sense. And I'll go back to that time in my life. When I think about those years, when I thought there'd never be any combat again, that are we, you know, almost like Harry Truman, you know, we don't need any military, you know, just a few, you know. Although I always appreciate the one thing, I lived overseas a lot, I traveled overseas a lot, and the most beautiful sight to me, and this happened in several cities, in several countries, but the most beautiful sight to me were Marines standing guard at an American embassy. They are the most beautiful people in the world. And I was one time caught up in a situation actually it was in Turkey, and that's long, long ago, before this new problem, but landed up, you know, running to the American embassy. And when you see these beautiful Marines, so gorgeous, at the end of every program, Ed salutes me and I salute him because I just love the military. But to see Marines standing guard, that's a beautiful sight.
Yeah, I think so too.
and so, you know, it's so important. I hope that there's a better understanding today about the sacrifices that our kids are making.
I think there is. I mean, certainly a lot better. These guys are being treated a whole lot better than we were treated when we came home from Nam.
Oh, so. The treatment when you guys came back from Nam was terrible. I shudder when I think of how really, really bad it was.
I know. I think a lot of people today, I think a lot of people can't believe that Americans would treat their own guys like that. I think I've told people some of the stories, and I mean, I was home for not even 24 hours, and they gave us 24 hours leave at El Toro, and I'd only been home for a few hours, and so when I got off the plane, though, I pushed I was on a hospital plane coming out of Okinawa, and a lot of those boys weren't going to live, and I was pushing a kid off who had lost his legs. And there were war protesters throwing eggs and tomatoes at us, and they were mooning us. And when they gave us leave, I mean, there was a platoon of MPs there, but the MPs weren't there to protect us. They were there to protect these guys, because if we could have gotten through this chain link fence, there would have been a few less war protesters. But when they gave us a leave, I went into town. And some of the bars in town had signs on them. The first one I went to had a sign on the front door: no dogs or Marines allowed in the bar. And then I went to another one, same sign. So I damaged their door. But I wasn't home even 24 hours, and I decked a guy in the Los Angeles bus terminal for spitting on my uniform. And two police were arresting a wino nearby, and they dropped the wino and grabbed me, threw me in the back of the cruiser. So I wasn't even home 24 hours, and I was on my way to jail.
Well, when I think about it, and I think I was never a protester. I wasn't, it's a little before, you know, I wasn't involved in that. And I wouldn't have been, because having a father who you know, was in the Army and who has a Silver Star, I could never see, you know, protesting in that way. And certainly not protesting the soldiers. If you're going to protest somebody, you know, protest the administration, the senators and the politicians and the representatives who get us into these messes, and not the soldiers. So it just was a terrible time, and I'm so happy that at least today we have this better understanding and respect, and certainly that we're honoring them in a much, much different way today. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's important. Now, Tim? Now you did that book, and I think it's a great book. And I hope, I'm hoping that at some point, now you self-published that book.
I did.
And one of the problems, of course, is when you self-publish, you don't get the distribution that a book that's published by a major house will get you. And so I'm hoping that at some point you'll get, and it happens. I've had some authors here who self-published their books, did not get major distribution, but later on, years later actually, had their books republished. And so I'm hoping, because I think your book is the type of book, just as Johnny, your books, they tell a story about a specific time that people will be interested in 50 years from now, 100 years from now. They'll want to understand about Vietnam. Or they'll even want to... I get such a kick every time I think of Section 8. It's just such a funny book.
And there's a lot of history in...
There's a lot of history.
There's a lot of history in Section 8.
You're interested in history, and you're interested in the Korean War era, and then you read that book, and it's so funny, and you're thinking, yeah, this is true. This stupid stuff that the people in charge were saying, they actually said it. I mean, and now you think, my gosh, we were led by a real bunch of idiots there.
Well, you know, there's some of those stories came from Francis Hugh Killeen, that same Irishman. And the story of breaking the German POWs out of a Marine Corps POW camp. That's a true story. These crazy Marines... The city of Tianjin, China, had 8 Germans that ran the city. They ran the waterworks. They ran everything. You know, they were the engineers that the Germans had sent to help the Japanese run the city of Tianjin, China. So when the war ended, these German engineers were left behind, high and dry. So the Marines come in. You know, we came into Tianjin, throw these Germans in a POW camp. And now the city of Tianjin is having trouble running because they needed these German engineers. So these crazy Marines broke the German engineers out of their own prisoner of war camp, put them in Marine uniforms, and leased them to the city of Tianjin, China for a profit.
I mean, it's stories like this that I just get such a kick out of this book.
I do too.
I think it's wonderful. And so, but Tim, tell us, what else have you worked on, and what are you working on now?
Well, right now I'm actually... So when I finished Worthy McGuire, I had people ask me, so what happens next? And I had book clubs or people, when they had read the book, so what happens to the family next? I said, well, what do you mean? It's done. It's thought it was pretty closed, you know, closure at the end. I started thinking about what could happen next to Worthy McGuire. So what I did was I started kind of thinking about the time that he was in Normandy. I had continued to do research about the Battle of Normandy, which was taking place after the invasion. And I thought, there's probably a story here. And so kind of did a little more research, a little more thinking. And so what I thought was, I want to tell the story from a slightly different perspective. And what was going to be a second book with two sections has actually turned into two more books. And this second book is actually about a German soldier who becomes a POW and is incarcerated right near the end of the war in England. And Hal Worthy is involved is he's the soldier that captures him. So this second story is about this German POW's experiences in a camp in Wales. And again, this is all based on the kind of the true history of what happened there. I had found out through one of my wife's cousins that there was a camp just outside of Cardiff called Island Farm Camp, which housed some of the worst Nazi Germans along with other soldiers. And they were involved in what was called the Great Escape for the Germans. And this happened in March 1945, where about 80 Germans broke out of this camp in Wales. And so I said, I can use that.
Oh, so that's a good one.
That is kind of the second book, and it's self-contained within the end of World War II. And then what happens in it at that book will have an impact on the third book, which brings us back to the Maguire family in the present time. So people wanted to know what happened with the kids and the dad. Book three picks up on that, and it's very much tied into book two. It sounds kind of confusing.
Well, but I actually, you know, as I said, when I read a book and I see it as a movie, and in this case, I definitely saw Worthy McGuire as a movie. What I loved about it is that you did have you had this backstory of the family, which is very also can be very funny, but it's complex. There's a lot of depth to it, and so I as I'm reading, I'm saying there's a lot he can do with these people. There's a lot, you know. We can, as you said, with the father and there's so much you can do. And I am happy that you are continuing, because it's like I want to know more about the family. I want to know more about Worthy. I want exactly to go back in time and you know, when we meet him in the beginning of the book, as you say, it starts off in present-day Detroit, and you at first you're not sure, do I like this guy or not? You know, maybe not. You know, I'm not sure I like this guy. But then he sort of grows on you, and now I want more. So I'm really looking forward to
Well, I'm working on that, and I'm also trying to find an agent, so that's...
okay, well, I hope that you do, and because I think it's a great, the idea is great. Worthy is a perfect name, because he is a worthy character, and I really, really hope that you do. Now, you have, you are not very active on social media, I don't think. I noticed that, my goodness. Really? You've got a Facebook page. You haven't written anything for months and months. I know. I have a Facebook page, and I am working very hard to be very faithful. That was my word for the year. You know, I had a woman on, an author who wrote a book called For Something or the Other. Now my mind went, but anyway, Gretchen Rubin, and she said you should pick a word at the beginning of the year and make that your word.
Okay.
So my word is Facebook, and I'm trying to get people to like my Facebook page, because I need like a zillion million Facebook likes. So but I know you are not active, so we don't want to push it. But now
I can't do it either. I had to get a Girl Friday.
Yeah,
that's what I call her, Girl Friday. Yeah. Her name is Tori McGee, and without her, I would have no social media presence at all. So she saves me. She knows all that stuff.
Yeah, because you really it's. Oh, it's so complicated.
I will try. I try. But I think, I don't have much to say today. But.
Yeah, I know. I know the feeling. But, of course, you have, Johnny, you have a nice webpage.
Yes. Girl Friday did it.
I was going to say, I don't think you sat down and did it. But it is nice, and it's got some good information there, so people can go and it's got some photos, and I always love photos. So it's, and there's contact information. You have a blog even. And you know,
well, a quick word about that, the blog I just did. It's Memorial Day, and it's about a kid that I think everybody should remember.
The bravest kid I ever knew. So they can go there. Do you want to? Just a minute. Oh my God! I don't have any time. I see. Big Ed is putting up his hand, and I've got 5 minutes. But I want to say, before I finish today, I want to thank both of you for coming in today because you are just wonderful. And I'm so happy that you were both in today so that you could talk about things. And I just want to say one other thing. I want to take a moment to remember NASA astronaut Alan Bean, who we lost this week. He was a fourth person on the moon. We've only had 12 so far. And I think of him every day because over my desk I have a poster of one of his beautiful paintings that he autographed for me. I had the pleasure of working with him when I was involved in writing the script for a book by Apollo astronaut Walt Cunningham, The All-American Boys. And Alan is in that book, and so he was very kind and generous and gave me a lot of his time. I visited him at his home in Houston, and we sat down, and he talked to me about what it was like for him to step onto the moon and about his astronaut days. So I was very honored. As I said, I have did a beautiful autograph to me. And so I have that over my desk, and I think of him every day. And I'm so very happy that I had the opportunity to spend some time with him and get to know him, because he was a wonderful, wonderful person, and he will be missed. But again, guys, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Patsy. It was a great honor, really.
Okay.
Yes, thank you, Patsy. It was a pleasure.
Okay, and Ed in the control room every day, okay? He said I have 2 minutes, and in a minute, he's going to salute me. But I want to tell everyone again, meanwhile, remember that really, one of the most wonderful things in life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, like your wonderful book, or maybe someday to see them on film or even in the small screen if it's not a big movie. So anyway, it is just not going to happen unless you actually stun or write. Is that correct, guys?
Right, that is correct. Huh?
You have to have that discipline to write. So I just want you, everybody, to say something nice to somebody, and especially support the USO and support all veteran causes. Just check them out and make sure that your donations are going to the right place. Okay? And say something nice to somebody today. So bye-bye, and I'm going to salute Ed. Because I always salute Ed, and he salutes me because I should have been a Marine. I would love to be a Marine. I'd love to be a drill sergeant because I just love ordering people around. So that would have been so much fun.
Unnatural.
Unnatural. That's right. Unnatural. I did. I woke my boys up every morning at 5 o'clock. No, I didn't. They were homeschooled. They slept late. Yeah, so that was. They were lucky. But anyway, bye bye for now. Bye.